So our first case for argument, our set of cases, United States versus Griggs. Ms. Smith, are you first?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Brianna Smith, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Wayne Moore. Mr. Moore's conviction should be reversed because of the two independent and substantial errors identified in our brief. I would like to focus on the unanimity error, the district court's failure to require the jury to unanimously agree on which overt act was committed in furtherance of the conspiracy. Time permitting, and if the court has questions about it, I am also prepared to discuss the other error, the failure to define the object of the conspiracy. There is nothing more basic or fundamental than the Sixth Amendment mandate that a criminal defendant must be convicted by a jury that agrees unanimously on each and every element of the offense. Mr. Moore was deprived of that right because the jury was not instructed to agree unanimously. That's plain error, because by the standard of plain error, it's obvious. Richardson v. United States requires unanimity with respect to the elements of an offense. United States v. Folly also requires it. Further,
well, what's the element they didn't agree on? I don't understand.
The overt act.
Why is that? I don't understand. They agreed there was an overt act. Why do they have to agree on what the overt act is?
Well, it's not.
How is that an element? I don't understand.
It's a fundamental element of conspiracy that it.
Well, what if they disagreed about the date on which the offense was committed? Would that matter?
The date would not be considered an element. It wouldn't be an overt act. In this case, Your Honor, it's...
You need an overt act, but does it... Why do they have to agree on what overt act it was? I don't understand.
Well, in order to establish that he committed conspiracy to do something, there were overt acts that were alleged in furtherance of that thing, and it seems to be a fundamental principle that a part of that would be agreeing as to which of those overt acts it was that he committed. I mean, this is something that goes to the very core of what you are doing when you're finding that someone conspired to do something. Now, the bar is already lowered because it doesn't have to be an overt act that he committed. It doesn't have to be something that's illegal, but the jury should have to agree about what that thing is that they're saying was done in furtherance of the conspiracy that's alleged by the government. And in this case, we can't even look to see in the record if there was any agreement about what that thing was. There were 121 overt acts. There were 12 jurors. There was no specific unanimity jury verdict form. There was no instruction by the court that they had to agree unanimously about which one of those things were. And so there's no way for us to, at this point, say that they did, in fact, agree about any of those things.
So are you saying that the judge should have submitted a special verdict with 121 questions on it?
No, I'm saying that the judge could have done a special verdict that required the jurors to agree about which one specific overt act was committed by Mr. Moore or by one of the other co-conspirators.
He would have to write on the special verdict what was the overt act?
That's one way to approach it, or he could have simply instructed them to agree unanimously, that they had to agree unanimously as to which specific overt act was committed in furtherance of the conspiracy, as alleged.
They have to go one through 121?
No, they could have picked any one willy-nilly, but they had to pick one, and they had to agree about the one that they picked. Mm-hmm. Similarly, in United States v. Folly, for example, perjury was the charge, and the jury was told there were two false statements that could have been made. This court reversed and required that the jury agree about which one of the two false statements. Now, in that case, you could have said, well, there were two false statements. We don't have to pick which one. We know there were false statements made. But instead, in order for Defendant Folly to be unanimously convicted of perjury, the jury had to agree about which one of those false statements was, in fact, made in furtherance of the perjury. Similarly, we argue that here, the jury for Mr. Moore was required to unanimously agree about which overt act was made in furtherance of that conspiracy. And in contrast, you can compare with Matthews, where you had an independent, separate count. Here, there was no separate count. Mr. Moore was not charged with wire fraud, so we can't look to anything else to see that they agreed about what it was that was done in furtherance of the conspiracy to commit wire fraud. In Matthews, it was a perjury count and conspiracy to obstruct justice. Because the perjury count contained a overt act that was exactly the same as an overt act in the conspiracy to obstruct justice, the court could look after the fact and say, well, they agreed about it because they also found him guilty of perjury. Here we don't have that same reliability. We don't have that ability at all. And therefore, we respectfully ask that you reverse Mr. Moore's conviction.
Why isn't this error harmless under the circumstances of this case? The jury received a general unanimity instruction, and we've got 120 alleged overt acts.
Right, and that's...
We assume from that there was unanimity on at least one of those, if not more likely many of them?
No, Your Honor. That's precisely why it is harmful. In other cases where it's been found harmless, there was some other independent thing that you could look to say there was agreement. Here there is nothing. As I said before, there was no separate count. There was no charge of wire fraud. There also was no verdict form. There was no specific instruction to agree unanimously. They weren't told they had to do that at all. Arguably, they had no knowledge that that was even a requirement for conspiracy to be found. So the error is harmful because there are simply too many permutations of 12 people trying to agree about...
What if you had four overt acts? Three jurors thought the defendant had committed the first. Three other jurors thought he'd committed the second. Three thought he'd committed the third. And three thought he'd committed the fourth. Wouldn't that mean that there was a very low probability that he hadn't committed at least one?
I'm not sure that it would mean that there was a low probability, but I am sure that that wouldn't be sufficient.
A very low probability because the probability that he had committed none of the four. Right, there'd be a 3/4 of a probability that he hadn't committed the first, 3/4 that he hadn't committed the second, 3/4. But when you multiply them together, it's a low percentage.
But that still wouldn't be unanimous agreement about any of them, and that wouldn't be sufficient.
Why would it matter? It would be unanimous agreement, or it would be. Well, certainly there's unanimous agreement that he committed an overt act. The problem is they have trouble agreeing on which overt act it is. Some think it's one, some think it's another. But the chances that they're all wrong and he didn't commit any overt act, that would be very slight. So I don't see what's the abuse or what are you worried about?
Well, if the jury agreed, given the range of overt acts and the fact that an overt act doesn't have to be criminal, the fact that an overt act could have been committed by another co-conspirator, the fact that an overt act is a fairly broad thing, it's even more dangerous in this case because it was so complex.
What is the danger? The only danger is that a majority of the jury, or I'm sorry, the only danger would be if one juror didn't think he committed any overt act.
Well, the danger is that he's not convicted of what he's charged with, because the overt act could
be... No, he's charged with a conspiracy, and that's all set forth, and a conspiracy plus an overt act. But he's not charged with a... Why do they have to agree on one of the 121?
Because he's charged with conspiracy.
What's the abuse that you're worried about?
The abuse that we would...
Is an innocent person going to be convicted because if we don't insist that they agree on the overt act?
Possibly, Your Honor.
How does that work?
Because the government must...
Each one of the jurors thinks that he committed a particular act. Maybe they each think it's a different act. What's the chance that they're all wrong and he didn't commit any act?
We don't know what the jurors thought in this case, and it's impossible to know.
You never know what they think, right?
In this case, it's even less possible.
What's special about this?
Because there were so many possible choices for them to choose from. And the danger is that if there were something completely unrelated, I mean, for that matter, you could have an overt act, you committed murder, that you were selling drugs. And if the charge is conspiracy to commit wire fraud, the overt act should be in furtherance of that charge. And it should be related to what is alleged to have happened, which is that he committed conspiracy to commit wire fraud. Here, because of the range of acts and the fact that it was a multiple defendant case, the fact that he was charged, but the fact that he was tried alone makes it even more dangerous. It makes it even more possible that the jury didn't agree on anything. We don't know what they agreed on. We don't know which acts they agreed on, and there's nothing to look at to say, well, yes, they clearly found he committed conspiracy to commit wire fraud because they also found that he committed wire fraud. That's not the case here. They were never told that they had to agree about which thing, and under the law, under law of conspiracy, they should have.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Smith. Ms. Hansen?
May it please the Court, my name is Rebecca Hansen, and I represent Roger Griggs in this appeal. I'd like to focus the Court's attention on the tax counts, and we'd stand on our briefs on the other issues. The government failed to prove certain key elements of the tax counts in this case.
Who are you representing?
Roger Griggs, sir.
The principal defendant, yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. The government failed to show that Roger Griggs had any federal tax that was due and owing for the years in question. Additionally, the government failed to prove that Roger Griggs willfully evaded being taxed or that he willfully failed to file a return.
Would that affect his sentence?
It might, Your Honor. It's a few years. The charges were, 5 years apiece. They are running concurrently.
Was he given a consecutive sentence for the tax?
Yes. On the tax due and owing, the evidence was lacking as to the element whether or not there was tax due and owing for Roger Griggs. Halfway through the trial, the government actually created a document that really is its only proof of this. That document is Government Exhibit 79, which is at A44 of the government supplemental brief. We can't verify the numbers that are on this document. There's no concrete explanation of what makes up the money or where the money came from. In fact, it's a very thin reed on which the government bases the tax counts against Roger Griggs. There is little that we do know about Government Exhibit 79. It was created by government witness Tom Hill, who was an IRS agent who attended the trial. He reviewed the evidence and the testimony, but on cross-examination, he acknowledged that Roger was not a signatory on the accounts that he examined. And because of this problem, Tom Hill explained that his methodology really was looking at the accounts for items that were purchased for the benefit of Mr. Griggs. That's at Volume 10, page 163 of the transcript. Mr. Hill never discloses what purchases he accounted for or how they were attributable to Mr. Griggs. In fact,
he admitted, though, didn't he, that he hadn't filed a tax return?
Yes, Your Honor, but the case law suggests that the government had an obligation to show that Mr. Griggs knew he had a legal duty to file. And there was
knew he had a legal duty to file?
Yes, the Cheek case.
I don't understand you. He didn't know he had to file income tax returns if he had an income?
I would dispute that he had an income, Your Honor, but the case law.
Well, there's certainly evidence that he had income.
Well, Your Honor, I would not concede that, but the willfulness.
You don't concede that there's evidence that he had income?
Well, Your Honor, that could be attributable to any of the defendants in this case.
I don't understand you.
Well, there was money in trust, Your Honor, and Roger Griggs was not a signatory on the accounts that Mr. Hill examined, and that money could have been.
So he had no income?
Your Honor, that's what I'm saying, yes.
Okay.
And the government, under Cheek, Cheek versus United States, had an obligation to prove that Roger Griggs knew he had a legal duty because willfulness has been defined as the violation of a known legal duty. In cases that the government cited, it was clear that.
No, wait, they have to prove that if he had an income, he knew he had to file an income tax return? Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. I believe the cases state that the defendant had to know, as opposed to being confused about
what
the law, that he had a legal duty to pay taxes.
Well, doesn't he know if he has income that he has to file income tax return?
Well, I think in this case where money was in trust and not in his name, that there was confusion. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, there was also evidence about these large homes and other properties that he owned.
He was acquiring
and then selling and rolling over the money into new properties, et cetera. Isn't that right?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the record shows that it's not Mr. Griggs that owned these properties, but the trust that purchased them. And the cases that the government cites show that in those cases, the government had proven that the defendant knew he had a legal duty to pay. In this case, there was no witness that showed that Mr. Griggs himself knew he had a legal duty to pay. And the government, in terms of Exhibit 79, wants to have it both ways. It showed I'm sorry. I see that my time is out. Okay.
Stop. It's not up to you to see the red light.
Okay. I'm confused by the rules. The government wants to have it both ways. It uses Government Exhibit 79 to show that this income was attributable to Roger Griggs when it could have been attributable to any of the defendants in this case. And it wants to tie the defendants to these accounts to prove its conspiracy charge on the one hand, but it also wants to use the document to convict Mr. Griggs on the tax charges.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hansen. Mr. Rehack?
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court, Mr. Grimmer. I have actually very little to say. I will rest primarily on Julie Griggs' brief, with the possible exception of saying that the government's position in relation to Julie seems to be that she should have known. The government also uses words from her husband, talking about Roger at one point saying that she was his partner, and another point saying that she makes herself scarce when he was conducting business meetings. Well, the government doesn't believe anything that Roger Griggs said at any other time, and don't believe that Roger should be believed here. There is, I tried the case on behalf of Ms. Griggs, probably the most complex case I've ever had to deal with. But the issue on appeal, and actually my issue in defending her, was also the most simple. There is absolutely no evidence of any kind that she ever had any involvement, any at all, in any of the investment conversations, the plans. She knew her husband was a businessman. He was bringing home the paycheck. Now, I'm in private practice myself. I pay bills. My better half does not ask me where the money comes from. It just gets paid. And that's what was happening with Julie Griggs and with her eighth grade education. In my brief, I listed four different types of people: the investors, employees, professionals, other people, none of which can link Julie Griggs at all to knowing anything about the illegal activity of her husband. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rehack. Mr. Jones?
May it please the Court, I represent Donald Griggs, and I would like to echo what Mr. Rehack said. Mr. Donald Griggs's connection with this case is even thinner than Julie Griggs. Of the 42-count indictment, Donald was charged and convicted of one count, and our argument is that the evidence with regard to Donald is insufficient to prove that he knowingly or intentionally became a member of the conspiracy or that he did anything in furtherance of the conspiracy. The evidence at trial was that he was duped, just like the investors, by Roger, that these orphans were going to come to these properties. And what Donald was charged with was maintenance. He was a laborer. He did a variety of tasks, dug ditches. He
wasn't he the president of one of these fraudulent companies?
In name only, Your Honor.
What does that mean?
That means he had no the only tie to that company was a signature. In other words, he didn't have any day-to-day obligations.
Well, why did he sign?
I don't know. That was not presented at trial.
Well, he opened bank accounts in the company's name, didn't he?
I believe there is one bank account that was opened as well. But, again, that's about as close as you can get. President of one of the companies, again, in name only, and I believe there was a bank account open. But primarily, the government called almost 100 witnesses at this trial. Very few of them knew Donald Griggs or had any involvement with him.
What did he think he was getting paid for?
Maintenance. He was a heavy equipment operator. He built barns. He cut brush. He did grass, ran electrical lines. He was
he got a check with a notation that he was an advisor?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That doesn't sound like maintenance.
He had no control over what somebody writes on the check that they give, that he's handed. I agree that I don't know what a person does when
Did he meet with some of the investors?
I think the testimony at trial was that he was present at some of the meetings. And we argue in our brief that mere presence is not enough. In other words, he didn't do any of the He didn't encourage anyone to give him money.
According to the government, maybe they're wrong, one of the investors said that Griggs was trying to make me feel more comfortable at this meeting, that this was a legitimate opportunity.
That's correct. I believe one of the...
This sounds like a maintenance function.
Well, he did attend meetings. He did travel, I believe, to Kentucky with his brother. And I do believe when people asked him how things were going, he said they were going fine.
How would he know if he's just doing maintenance?
That's our point exactly. He was just doing maintenance. As far as he knew...
So what was his basis for telling them everything was going great?
Well, he was doing everything that Roger had asked him to do.
Pretty convenient. Just say, oh, my brother told me.
I believe that's what the evidence was at trial.
That doesn't.
Excuse me?
The jury doesn't have to believe that.
They do not.
Okay, well, thank you. Mr. Carlson?
May it please the court, I was appointed to represent Sean Schroyer in this case. I relied largely on what was contained in our brief and the supplemental brief, but I want to emphasize to the court that anything that Sean Schroyer did or said was done at the direction and control of Roger Griggs. And Mr. Schroyer went
for... Not a defense.
Judge, he relied in good faith on the things that Mr. Schroyer told him when he would question Mr. Schroyer about documents or about meetings or things like that. He was given answers by Mr. Griggs, which he believed. He believed partially because he was married to Mr. Griggs's daughter. He did not believe that his father-in-law would lead him down the wrong path. That information was consistent with information that he was provided by other people, Steve Gaby, Len Beamer, Art Edelman, and others. He had every reason to believe that the information that he was given was truthful information. It seemed reasonable to him. It didn't raise red flags to him. And he never acted without the direction of Roger Griggs. He didn't say anything to people. He
promising
didn't.
Promising returns of 1,200% didn't raise a red flag?
Well, Judge, he indicated he believed that, and part of that came from one of the meetings with the receiver, Michael Quilling. Mr. Schroyer wasn't present at that meeting. But
well,
that's
not necessary. It's just a matter of common sense that you don't sign your name on a document promising returns of 1,200% unless you're deeply embroiled in the conspiracy.
Well, he was told that in the meeting with the receiver, that the receiver had indicated that those weren't something that could be done on a regular basis, but that they had done nothing wrong. And that's what he believed, and that's why he acted the way he did. I see my time is up.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Grimmer?
Morning, Your Honors. I was the trial counsel, and so any shortcomings in those trials or in those instructions fall right on my shoulder. However, I believe that as I go through the facts and the evidence, I believe that that all of these convictions should be affirmed. Let me start off by advising the court that Julie Griggs, Sean Schroyer, and Roger Griggs all testified. And they had an opportunity to explain to the jury their relative positions. And Roger Griggs was in charge. He said he was in charge. And he also said that others had something to do with helping him, but he downplayed it. And he said he was the man in charge. He also, and so the jury had an opportunity to hear their side fully. And they were cross-examined. And I would invite the court that when you have an opportunity, or if you already have, to look at both direct and cross, especially of Roger Griggs and Julie Griggs and Sean Schroyer, Donald Griggs did not testify, that provides, I believe, a great deal of information about what each was doing. Certainly, the jury was presented with the issue of whether or not Sean Schroyer, Donald Griggs, and Julie Griggs knew what was going on. Now, with respect to, I guess, Donald Griggs, I believe that the evidence was more than sufficient to show his knowledge. Lawrence Bradley and Ronald Keeble talked about Roger Griggs running some interference with investors. Donald was in some meetings, and one of those was a big meeting. On November 12th of 1999 in Shepherdsville, Kentucky, Louis Floor, an auto mechanic for 23 and a half years, invested $1 million. That meeting, during that entire meeting, Donald Griggs was present. He was introduced as the manager of this particular operation. Donald talked to Lawrence Bradley, another major investor, about insured investments. He showed Ron Keeble, another investor, properties and gave assurances that things were going all right. Several witnesses described Donald Griggs as being in meetings, and Roger Griggs introduced his brother as his confidant. I believe that was to witness Mike McIntyre. He was listed on an advisor as on a check, and I agree, you can't control what someone puts on a check, but combined with the other evidence, it certainly goes to the issue of knowledge. I would like to address the issue of the bank account because I think that's important. Not only being an officer of the corporation, he also, Lake City Bank was the account. Out of Lake City account, that was a Don Strong account. I believe he was president of Don Strong. That was opened December 22nd of 1998 after Mr. Quilling shut down Howell Financial Trust. Lake City Bank received investor funds, including a $300,000 deposit that I believe went from Illinois to Kentucky to Indiana to Lake City Bank. A check for a wire of $132,000 out of Lake City Bank was used to help make the final payment on the Pottawatomie property, which was an asset of Howell Financial and which was hidden from Mr. Quilling, the receiver. The closing that took place on June 1st of 1999 of that particular property that should have been turned over to the receiver was attended by Donald Griggs. He signed the documents according to Sally Hernandez, who testified, and Roger Griggs confirmed that Donald Griggs was at that particular meeting. That particular piece of property, I believe, had originally been in the name of Howe Financial, and it was transferred to another company called Strongheart, in which Donald Griggs also was associated. We also know that Donald Griggs viewed properties with other people. He signed certain documents. I believe there was testimony from Jack Barbin that on his paperwork he dealt with specifically with Roger Griggs. When he got his paperwork, it had Donald's signature on it.
What about the issue of the overt acts for Moore? The failure to
First of all, I would compliment the other side. I thought their brief was well done, and I thought that it raised a lot of issues. But I guess I'm going to start off at the end and say the worst-case scenario. If, in fact, this court were to find that there was error, and even that it was plain error, I would suggest to the court that you still have discretion as to whether or not to reverse.
I understand, but what about the issue of... Was it necessary for the jury to agree on one of the overt acts?
Well, they have to agree that an overt act was committed.
Right,
in further.
But do they have to agree on which act is the one?
They have to agree that there was one act.
No, but do they have to agree on which one it was? That's the question.
I don't believe they do, Your Honor. I certainly they were told that to prove conspiracy, the government had to prove an overt act in furtherance of it, and that their verdict had to be unanimous. And certainly, we probably could have done a better job, both the defense counsel and myself, but if we wanted to get more specific, give him a special verdict form. We didn't do that. So
there is a general instruction that had to be unanimous,
Your Honor.
But it just didn't talk about whether that meant they had to agree on the overt act. That just wasn't discussed.
It was not discussed at any of the instructions.
The closing argument, or was there anything about the overt act?
No, I don't believe that the whole issue in the case was not about the overt acts. It was whether or not Mr. Moore knowingly joined the conspiracy. As his attorney said, Mr. Griggs, as we knew, he described Mr. Griggs as someone who could steal sweetness out of sugar, and that was the idea that Mr. Moore was nothing more than a victim. And then the government obviously had a response for that, and the jury was left to decide. But the issue before the jury was never about whether or not these overt acts had been committed. It was whether or not Mr. Moore knowingly joined. And on that particular point, I respectfully believe that the evidence was overwhelming as to his knowledge. We did something a little bit different in Mr. Moore's trial. We brought in several other witnesses, including a Les Taylor and a Robert Schultz, who were people that were working with Wayne Moore and who, in fact, testified that they had gathered approximately...
Why were the instructions different in Moore's trial? Was Moore's trial, I take it, was it after the others?
The attorney for Mr. Moore, Your Honor.
Because the same judge.
Same judge.
Why wouldn't he just give the same instructions?
I don't know the answer to that. And I do know that the trial was broken up into several portions. There were a couple of delays. Bottom line is that it was on a Saturday. I don't know. And to the extent that there are shortcomings in the instructions, I am responsible for those.
There was another instructional error as well. There was
right.
No instruction on the object of the conspiracy,
absolutely.
The wire fraud.
Right. And I'm going to go back to, is that error? Sure, there should have been a more detailed instruction, but did, in fact, the jury know what Mr. Moore was charged with? Absolutely. They had a copy of that indictment. They were instructed about scheme to defraud and what it was all about.
But they weren't instructed on the elements of wire fraud.
No, they were not. They were certainly told about wire fraud and that it was an agreement to commit wire fraud, and they certainly had that on page 9 of the indictment, which is count 7. They certainly knew that.
Weren't they told... I'm sorry.
No instruction on the jurisdictional element of the use of the wires.
That is correct, although I would... again, suggest to the court that if you find that that's error and that it's plain error, again, I would indicate to the court that was not the whole idea. Was do you send it back because the result, we have a miscarriage justice here, or the system, you know, shouldn't stand for that kind of error? And we respectfully say no, you shouldn't, because quite frankly, the evidence was overwhelming as to Mr. Moore's guilt. And I know that that's not in and of itself sufficient, but we weren't fighting about interstate nexus at the trial. We were fighting about knowledge. And had we not properly asked Judge Sharp to talk about knowledge and what constitutes knowledge, then I would be in a different position, I think, in terms of what we'd have to do, asking this court to do if you find that there's plain error. Yes, sir.
You're trying to piece together the indictment with the jury instructions. Weren't they told the indictment's just a charging document? That's sort of the general...
Absolutely. Judge Sharp was careful to point out that this is not evidence, that it is merely a tool for them. It is, in fact, though, the government had an obligation, Judge Sharp told them in the final instructions, that the government must prove the indictment as charged in count 7, and you have a copy of count 7.
Okay, and can I also ask you, one of the points that Ms. Smith's brief brings out is the difference between a structural error and a non-structural error, and we know from Nieder that if there's one element gone, it can be a harmless error. But what happens if there's the whole charge is gone, basically?
Well, again...
What's the analysis there?
Well, I think the question you have to ask yourself is whether, if there's plain error, okay, does it rise to the level that, in fact, it would require reversal? That is, are we talking about errors here where, in fact, there was an innocent person who was convicted? Will the judicial proceedings stand for these kind of errors? And I guess I go back to my point with Judge Sykes. If what we were talking about was just simply knowledge was the crux of the defense, nobody here had any problems with the issue of the interstate nexus.
When you say any problems, did any of the witnesses talk about the use of the telephone, or what are we talking about?
Mr. Fernandez, Mr. Geis, Ann Mitchell, Mr. Espinoza, all were witnesses that testified about the wires. Mr. Battle, I believe, Tim Kennard, there were numerous witnesses that talked about that.
Did the defendant, I assume, had witnesses? Did they have any witnesses?
No, Your Honor.
They had no witnesses?
No, Your Honor.
Did the cross-examination of the government witnesses try to challenge any of the testimony that was about the use of the telephone or anything?
No, Your Honor. The questions on cross certainly went to the theory of knowledge, and I think that goes back and says, should this court exercise its discretion if you find that we screwed up, all of us, defense counsel, the court, the trial court, and me, and I take responsibility because I'm the government and I'm supposed to know better. But the question is does that require reversal? You can exercise your discretion and say, no, it wasn't an issue in this case.
Is it the same question, whether you're saying clear error, is the same question if it's structural error? Clear error and structural error, those are the
structural
same
error, I mean, obviously, if we had picked a jury that wasn't impartial because we picked it on some improper classification, or Judge Sharp somehow was biased against
the victim of the fraud.
Yeah. Then I'm out.
But we know from Nieder that one element missing is okay.
Right.
This is more than one element. Is that's still okay though?
It's okay in light of the fact that you do have discretion. You have to look at the entire record and really what was the issue in this particular case. It was knowledge and whether or not Mr. Moore had knowledge. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's a sliding scale, that the government gets so many bumps, because I don't think that's right. I think we should do it right the first time. But I think you have to look at the entire record in this case to decide whether or not the error amounts. I mean, we go back. If you reverse and we go back down, we're still going to be fighting about knowledge. That would be my assumption, that we're not going to be fighting about interstate wires, because there really wasn't any dispute about that. You know, Ann Mitchell, Bobby Geis, Mr. Fernandez, all people, all investors who sent money to Texas, where Mr. Moore controlled that account, and then that money came up to Indiana, $800,000. So it really wasn't an issue in the case.
Okay.
With respect, have I answered your question?
Is there anything further?
Well, I would like to talk about Julie Griggs.
Okay.
And again, Julie Griggs did have an eighth grade education, but she also had an opportunity to testify and put her credibility before the jury, and I would ask you not to reweigh that. Some of the things that I pointed out, and I do think are important, is certainly she knew that Roger Griggs had been to prison. She testified, I think, that Roger Grigg never told her what he did, and she never asked. There was testimony from Greg Chapman, who did talk to Roger and say that Julie would get up and leave whenever they would talk about business, but that's so that she could truthfully at some point say she didn't know what was going on. And I guess
an ostrich instruction?
It was an ostrich instruction, Your Honor. And I believe that I thought it was interesting in terms of knowledge. She was present at certain meetings where things were discussed. Ernie Piotrowski was the IRS agent, where she went in to talk to Mr. Piotrowski about her tax problems. Roger was also there with her. Linda Knoll. Linda Knoll was the realtor. I'm sorry, I lost my point. My point was, in March of 2000, Julie Griggs is in front of Piotrowski talking about taxes and basically signing a debt collection thing that they have $77. Now, they also indicate they had some stuff in trust. After that, a month later, she's with Linda Knoll and Roger Griggs when they're buying the Finley property, Charles O. Finley property, and Roger's telling Linda Knoll that he's an attorney. Now, he clarifies that later by saying, well, I'm an attorney for the Indian Nation. But she was present during that particular interview. Then we get her in June talking to Michael Spencer, who's sitting down and have a meeting, and he's an $40,000 investor, and he says, geez, how are you going to do all these things with the orphans? How are you going to be able to do, you know, handle all that? And she reassures him that she's going to be able to handle it. She opened bank accounts, Bank One bank account in Elkhart, where investor funds went through. She paid her IRS bill with investor funds that went through her bank account, and we traced all of that. In terms of the tax counts, I would just simply advise the court that on the tax counts, we did present the testimony of Tom Hill. I think Roger Griggs' own testimony that he was in charge, he certainly wanted to sort of have everybody else do his dirty work in terms of opening up accounts, and he directed that. But certainly, I think the jury was free to determine that all of this was his income. With respect to Sean Schroyer, again, he told Greg Chapman, quote, he told me he didn't know how Roger Griggs got the money, but he knew that he'd have it coming in big, you know, as it started coming. He signed documents. He met investors, Bradley, Floor, and Klosowski. He was an officer of Don Strong and Strong Heart. He opened bank accounts, took investors to the banks. He did Roger's bidding at the bank. He got, there's a check in there in our appendix that he was an advisor. He was the computer guy, and he was going to help Roger with the trades, according to Carl Klosowski, a chiropractor who was defrauded and met Sean. He knew about the orphan program. He knew there were no orphans, and he resurfaced back in Alabama after they were left here, Indiana, went back down to Alabama, surfaced with Roger in 2001 in September, opening up a bank account called the Southern Cherokee United Diocese, where proceeds from investors on the Mishler property were wired. He was an active participant, his desk was 10 feet away from Roger Griggs at the Pottawatomie property when he met with Lawrence Bradley and Jack Regan. He knew Roger had been in prison. During that meeting, Roger Griggs told Regan that he had never done time. I think the phrase was, Mr. Griggs, have you ever done time? His response was, of course not. And I asked Sean on cross-examination, how far were you in that meeting from Roger Griggs? And he was 10 feet away. And he also knew Mr. Griggs had gone to prison. So we submit that based upon all of this, that there is sufficient evidence, that we have not attempted to manipulate any of these facts to create any kind of illusion for this court. We have set forth those facts. It was Mr. Griggs and his family that, in fact, created this illusion of wealth that defrauded folks of about $4 million.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Grimmer. So would any of the defendants' lawyers like some rebuttal time? Ms. Smith?
The bottom line is the question of whether appellate judges or juries decide a defendant's guilt based on the elements of the defense. The Fifth and Sixth Amendment require that it's juries that make that decision. Richardson requires unanimity, and it's crystal clear under Richardson that that was what should have happened here. There should have been unanimity with respect to the element of the offense. The fact that there were so many possibilities here, where in United States v. Folly, it was harmful for two possibilities. Here there were 121 possibilities.
Grimmer says the only issue was knowledge. It wasn't an issue of overt acts or use of interstate communications facilities.
That's impossible to be true, Your Honor. It's a structural error that the jury wasn't even told what they were to find a conspiracy of what to do.
That's not the... I mean, what's the... As he said, where is the miscarriage of justice? Why reverse... I mean, that's an element of plain error. If you're confident that the result would be the same, we don't have to reverse just because an error is plain. Plain in a sense of clear.
We can't be confident that the result will be the same. We can't be confident for unanimity because there were...
What would have led a rational jury to decide, hey, I don't think they... That if there had been an instruction on use of interstate facilities, that a juror would have said, oh, Moore used an interstate facility, or that any of the defendants used an interstate facility. That would be irrational, wouldn't it?
It wouldn't be...
No one made an issue of it. It just...
What is required is that the jury was told what to do and instructed properly on that. They weren't told what the conspiracy was about. They weren't instructed on what the conspiracy was to do. That's more than just they weren't told whether or not the amount was material. They weren't told anything. They weren't told whether or not the use of wires was reasonably foreseeable. That was a part of finding conspiracy to commit wire fraud, and they weren't instructed about it.
But the defendant didn't try to make an issue of that.
And that's why it's plain error. But it's clearly harmful, and that's why it should be reversed.
No, it's not. It's only harmful if we could say that if the error hadn't been committed, there would have been some reasonable probability of an acquittal. That's why I don't see how the jury could have acquitted on this evidence.
Well, the standard of harmful error would be that the government would have to show that absent the error, the verdict would have been the same. And there's been no showing of that. There's no way to show that, absent the error of instructing the jury about unanimity, that they would have been able to agree unanimously about a specific act.
Actually, on plain error review, the burden is on you.
For harmless error review. I was referring to harmless error review.
But we're on plain error review, aren't we?
With respect to plain error review, it's an obvious error that the jury should be told what the conspiracy is to do.
I think there's no question that there were multiple instructional errors in this case.
Correct.
And the question is whether that's structural or whether it's subjected to either harmless error review if the error was preserved, which it wasn't, or in this case, plain error review. So the burden is not on the government. It's on you because we're in plain error land and not harmless error land.
With respect to in plain error land, correct, the burden is on us. And we have demonstrated that it would be harmful to Mr. Moore if in a case where they had two choices, this court reversed saying that wasn't enough. Clearly, if there's 121 choices, that's too many. It's harmful to Mr. Moore because given that amount of choices...
It's not harmful if no one thought there was any question that there were covert acts, right?
But no one thinks that now. That's not what the jury knew at the time.
But at the trial, before the instructions, his lawyer had a chance to say, oh, no overt acts. Just talk. But he didn't say that. Didn't make an issue of that.
He made an issue of whether or not Mr. Moore knew about the wires or knew...
From the overt acts.
For the overt acts, out of the 121 acts, Mr. Moore was only mentioned in six of them. I mean, so we're not... This is not a clear-cut case of they adequately presented...
But his lawyer didn't make an issue. The lawyer didn't say, look, could have said that this was just talk, there were no acts, just talk, and that's not enough. Could have said that, but he didn't.
Right, and that's why at this point we're asking for the court to reverse and remand for a new trial, because he didn't...
You have to. It's not a plain error case. You have to show it's a so-called structural error, right? But why? I don't know why. I mean, it's one thing. So the root structural error is where the police, the prosecutors say, well, this person is so guilty, we're just going to skip the trial, put him directly into prison. Okay, that would obviously, that's wrong. No matter how guilty the person is, he's entitled to a trial. But if he's obviously guilty, or at least there's no issue about the overt acts and the use of interstate communications, then...
But the government is still required...
What's the injustice?
Because the government is still required under the Fifth Amendment to be put to its proof for every element of the offense, and they clearly weren't here if the jury wasn't instructed about it.
No, you're not complaining about absence of proof. You're complaining about absence of an instruction. That's very different from absence of proof.
The instruction goes to what the jury could find, and the jury's finding is based on what the government proved, and here they weren't instructed on what to do, and so we don't know what they found.
Any instructional error then would be structural in your view?
No, I'm saying these two instructional errors are ones that require reversal.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Smith. Does anyone else want to say anything? Ms. Hansen? Not the taxes.
Your Honor, I just want to point out that the government just spoke about how the money was attributable to Julie Griggs, the Don Strong account was attributable to Donald Griggs, and at the end of the day, we don't know what the underlying facts of the numbers on Government Exhibit 79 are, and so how could the jury find beyond a reasonable doubt that it was Roger Griggs' income?